This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
This is Book of Serenity, Case 18, Zhaozhou's Dog, Part 2. Pointer. A gourd floating on the water, push it down and it turns. A jewel in the sunlight, it has no definite shape. It cannot be attained by mindlessness, nor known by mindfulness. Immeasurably great people are turned about in the stream of words. Is there anyone who can escape? The case. Student asked Master Zhaozhou, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? And Zhaozhou said, yes. The student says, since it has, why is it then in this skin bag? Zhaozhou said, because it knows, yet deliberately transgresses. Later, another student asked Zhaozhou, does a dog have Buddha nature? And Zhaozhou said, no. The student said, all sentient beings have Buddha nature. Why doesn't a dog have it? Zhaozhou said, because it still has impulsive consciousness. The poem. A dog's Buddha nature exists. A dog's Buddha nature does not exist. A straight hook basically seeks fish who turn away from life, chasing the air, pursuing fragrance, cloud and water travelers. In noisy confusion, they make excuses and explanations. Making an even presentation, he throws the shop wide open. Don't blame him for not being careful in the beginning. Pointing out the flaw, he takes away the jewel. The king of Qin didn't know Lian Zhangru. So the other day I spoke about the second part of this koan where Zhaozhou responds in the negative. Today I want to look at the other part. And I think I mentioned Zhaozhou is pretty well known in our tradition. He lived in the latter part of the 8th century and almost all of the 9th century. He lived for a very long time, about 120 years. And was in the Dharma for almost all of that time, for more than a century. So you can imagine this being. And he spent much of his early years, well into middle age, studying with Master Nanquan. And then he went traveling and studied with a number of, met a number of different teachers, and eventually settled in the town of Zhaozhou, where he took his name. And he, a lot of his teachings are very, sometimes referred to as lips and mouth sin, that he didn't use sort of sudden, startling strikes and shouts, but he used language. He was very, evidently very fond of the Faith Mind poem. There are many dialogues in his records of teachings drawn from that. Number of teachings where he responds to this question, does a dog have Buddha nature? And he's sort of held up in the tradition as a example of a fine student who was a student all of his life. And I think that's something that we would all do well to aspire to. That wherever we are in our journey and in practice, that we first and foremost be students. I think when that's alive and well, then we're in a good place. And we're in a good place to continue to develop and to meet all that we will. And when it's not true, then we're kind of already in trouble. And so, you know, we talk about beginner's mind and the mind of the student, student mind. It's not a thing. It's something we can practice. It's something we cultivate. I think at its heart, it's really living out of that basic state of wonder that we all possess as human beings. It seems to have been with us as long as we have been human beings on this earth, wanting to understand, wanting to know, wanting to look beyond the horizon and see what's there. And because the world is so vast and rich and frightening, it seems that so much of our looking, certainly in latter years, has been definitely outside and over outside the horizon, and not enough inside. And these earlier beings, certainly in our tradition, lived in time where that journey, that inward journey, seems to have been valued, not by everybody, I'm sure, but that there was a culture of religious, of seeking, and that people who were practitioners were held in regard. Again, not by everybody, but there was a sense of them having a role to play that I think was integrated with the whole sense that the world is is all one piece, and that from the ordinary people all the way up to whoever was in charge, that everyone had a role, and that role was completely integrated with nature, with the universe, with the way things worked. And if things weren't working, it's because somehow those roles were out of place, or something was sort of out of harmony. And of course, those roles can be, you know, become very solidified and not always bringing a benefit. But that sense of an inner life of seeking, of asking, and wanting to understand ultimate matters as being something that does matter, and that has a place within our society, and that people who are doing that have a role. For instance, that monasteries have a role to play within a society doesn't really exist in our society, Eastern or Western tradition. I think maybe that's not so good. Does a dog have Buddha nature? Yes. Since it does, why is it then still in this skin bag? Why is it in this body? Zhaozhou says, because it knows, yet deliberately transgresses. Another translation says, as Zhaozhou saying, knowingly, the dog dares to be this way. The footnote to that line says, don't assume he's not talking about you. I think we should also keep this close to heart. Don't assume it's not being spoken to us, for us. What else is the Dharma but that? What other purpose does it have? Why else is it here? Why did the Buddha spend his whole life teaching? And entering into all of the wonderful, I'm imagining, positive, fulfilling aspects of that, and a lot of some of the headaches of that. He did it for those people who wanted to study, who, as he said, had little dust in their eyes and wanted to see into the horizon. All living beings are all Buddha nature. The Tathagata is continuously abiding and not subject to change, the Buddha said in Dogen's fascicle on Buddha nature. Dogen comments on that line and says, know that the are of all our Buddha nature is beyond are and are not. All are the Buddha's words, the Buddha's tongue. They're the eyeball of Buddha ancestors and the nostril of sincere students. The words all are Buddha nature, are not limited to embryonic beings, original beings, and conceivable beings, or any other kind of beings. Furthermore, they don't mean causal beings or imaginary beings. All are free from mind, from object, from essence, from aspects. This being so, the body, mind, and environs of living beings all are Buddha nature, are not limited to the increasing power of action, to imaginary causation, to things as they are, or the practice realization of miraculous powers. Dogen often speaks of beyond. Know that the are of all our Buddha nature is not beyond are or are not, going beyond Buddha, he taught. And this beyond doesn't mean higher, doesn't mean better. It means not bound, not defined, not determined, not confined. Beyond are and are not, as Dogen says, is not an abstract philosophical idea, neither existent nor non-existent, neither this nor that. In other words, don't assume it's not about you. And because we're not accustomed, unless we've had some training, perhaps in philosophy, religious studies, we're not really accustomed, and maybe even then, but we're not accustomed to really thinking about ultimate things and in ultimate terms. And so it's a little bit of learning a language, somewhat of words and language, but more of how to reflect, how to examine, how to look at things that are ultimate. What does that mean? When I graduated high school, I moved out to Dallas, Texas. I kind of wished it was in Colorado, thinking about it now, but it wasn't. It was in Texas. So I apologize to all you Texans, but and I was I went out there for love, but while I was out there, I was doing other things. And one of the things I did was I went to a local university, and I just used to wander into classes and sit down and just listen, because I was curious about what I wanted to do, what I wanted to study, what was I interested in. And so I went into different classrooms. Sometimes the professors didn't like that, so I kind of had to pick larger classrooms where I would get lost in the crowd, because I didn't have any money to pay for auditing. And it was a private college. So anyway, one of the things I was interested in was astronomy. So I sat in this astronomy class. My great aunt, when I was a little boy and visiting my cousins in Miami, would take me out at night. I'm not quite sure why me and why, how that all happened, but she would take me out at night, and she was teaching me about astronomy. She gave me some books, and she would point out constellations, and we'd talk about it. And so when I sat in on this class, it was like I felt like I was encountering something that was in the realm of the ultimate. And the ways, the analogies that would be used to try and give a conceptual sense of distances and time scales that were just unimaginably long, was like mind-bending. And there was something about that that was intriguing. And it's actually what I ended up going to college to study, although I didn't stay in that. And that's partly why it's difficult when we engage the Dharma, because the Dharma is speaking on that level, and particularly in the Zen tradition, these direct teachings are really speaking to your enlightened mind before it's realized. From mind to mind, that's what that means. And so when we listen to it with our ordinary way of thinking, where we try and grab onto it and conceptualize and relate it to and figure it out and organize it, and, you know, it gets frustrating. And many of the sutras are like that. They sort of break our hold on things. They're mad crazy in terms of how they present universes and beings, right? To sort of shake us loose. Dogen says the words "all are" not limited to any type of being. No one's left out. And so they reach everywhere, into everything, and they speak directly to you and me. That's their purpose. That's who Dogen is speaking to us. He's not speaking to the universe. He's not speaking for posterity. He's speaking to people. He was sitting in a hall somewhat like this, facing people, teaching for their benefit, saying, assume I'm talking to you. And he says, and this every being is free from mind, object, essence, aspects. They're not bound or defined or the same as mind or an object apart from my mind or any kind of permanent essence, eternal thing, or aspects, characteristics. And this is what we're practicing to realize, both to be free of all things that we would grasp onto, identify with, compare ourselves to, base our happiness on, try to possess. But to realize this is not yet enough. We have to practice manifesting it. And it's really important to appreciate that in Buddhism, that's not, you know, sort of for what happens later. It is the Buddha Dharma. Because otherwise, it's too narrow. It's too limited. It's almost just like a mind liberation, but not a world, being, universe liberation. Which means in our manifesting, we have to bring it into and practice it and harmonize what we are practicing with everything that we're doing. And we speak about that all the time. And we speak about that in terms of specific practices, like kinhin and liturgy and caretaking practice. But it's not just doing these things as a meditation. It's experiencing them as non-dual, as unified, as free from mind and object and essence and aspects. And that's particularly important when we're in a realm where there are boundaries, and the boundaries are very clearly defined, deeply established. And that's why the study of gender, of race, of class, of patriarchy is so important. Because these boundaries are so deeply established, so deeply integrated within our being. And also, when the consequences of what we're stepping into are so great. Last night when I was meeting with students, and again this morning, a couple of different people brought up, in essence, as one person said, she said, if I don't really practice diligently, meticulously, I'll lose my mind because of what's going on. I'll get lost. And so she said, I have to be very alert. And I said, that's excellent. That's what we mean by practicing like your head's on fire. You know, that when your back is against the wall, you can't mess around. Right? You have to really, as Dogen said, when you're I was saying this morning, remembering when Dogen and the Zwi Monkey said, if you're riding a horse and you get thrown from the horse, on your way down, you're not thinking about what's for lunch, right? You're not thinking about, you know, somebody that irritated you last week. You're thinking of one thing. And then how to hold that kind of awareness in a relaxed way. And in a way in which you are living with the hope of tomorrow. Dogen says, this being so, the body, mind, and environs of living things, that is, we ourselves, are all Buddha nature and are not limited to the increasing power of action, imaginary causation, things as they are, or the practice realization of miraculous powers. It's very interesting. So we're not bound by anything, and that allows us to not be limited in the increasing powers that we are, that we possess and that we're stepping into. And that they're already present, already manifest. So all of our efforts this week are not increasing your Buddha nature by one grain of salt. And nothing you do, no matter how difficult the week has been for you, has not decreased it either. It is not limited, which means you are not limited in your Buddha nature, which means it's not limited by time and place, by our mood, by our faith, by our perseverance, by our sincerity, by our right understanding, by how much time we spend in meditation. It's not even limited by our own limiting views. So then why do we experience so much limitation? Why do we experience the world and ourselves as being confined and limited, held back? We do live in a world of limits. And in having a physical body, living in a physical world, and our fundamental nature is not that. It's not apart from it, but it's not defined by that. In a sense, that really is the ultimate question, is what is the distinction in our mind between our lived experience and true reality? Isn't that gap, that fracture, that disunion or that disjointedness, isn't that the seat of our dis-ease? The sense of something and then our lived experience. And so training, in essence, invites us into that whole scene. We ourselves are Buddha nature. We bring that with us. We enter into a training environment which by law is limited. It can't be everything, right? If we're going to practice together, then we have to do things some ways, not other ways, at certain times, not other times, for this amount of time, not for that amount of time. And none of those are fixed, right? And that's why practice and training is evolving. It is in a state of evolution. And that tension of wanting to revere and respect our tradition and the wisdom that went into the traditional forms of practice, and at the same time that we meet them in our time and place and examine. For instance, from within the view of those boundaries. And then we see what is skillful and what is not skillful, what brings forth compassion, what actually is conducive to a very deep and deepening meditation, and also brings us forward into contact so that we can develop ourselves. So we can increase the powers of action, Dogen says, our mindfulness, our samadhi, our intention, our fearlessness, our thoughts, words, and actions, everything that we bring forth, that we're not limited in the increasing power that as we practice, all that the things that we do, in a sense, gain power. That's why Zazen is so important. It's so powerful because it's focused, it's concentrated, it's intentional. And the more we practice well, the more we're in alignment, in a sense, with the nature of the universe, with the laws and the force and the energy and the wisdom of the universe. That's a powerful thing. And we're training our mind to return to that state of alignment, if you will. And in the same way that when we're very distracted and kind of, you know, a little all over the place, we're still acting, but our actions, they don't have that kind of power. Sometimes they're very powerful because we're not paying attention. And we do things that are very harmful, but they're not coming out of an inner power. The increasing power of imaginary causation. So in that sense, all of our actions are imaginary in the sense, not that we are imagined making them up, but that our mind is knowing them. And in that, they are mind. They don't exist anywhere else. And so that's what Dogen is calling imaginary causation. Action and consequence. We can also think of that as visualizing, a visualizing practice, a koan practice, visualizing a deity or a mandala, visualizing well-being for people who are sick, for someone you love. The practice of tonglen or giving and taking, that you take the pain and the suffering of someone and you visualize that as a dark, massive, sooty smoke, and then you give them, you offer them in your mind the light of well-being, of peace, of serenity, of healing. Imaginary causation, which has influence, has impact. The power of imagining. When I was studying music, my teacher, when I was preparing for a performance, my teacher would often say, you know, that when I'm not playing the instrument, that I should sit and just perform the piece in my mind the way I want to play it and embody it. And he wasn't a meditator, he wasn't a practitioner. But he said, see it. See yourself playing that. Bring that to mind. Not being a practitioner, he understood something that Buddhism understands. The increasing power of things as they are, the increasing aliveness, acuity, the vibrancy. I was reading a book on things of the woods, and the author was talking about chickadees. This very simple black-capped chickadee that we have here, that's such beautiful little birds that are with us all year. Have such a beautiful little chickadee, dee, 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 dee. So small, so tiny. And that they're quite widespread. So they're southern chickadees, and they're smaller because the larger ones, they become larger in northern climates because that's one way they keep warm. More body mass generates more heat. But what he was talking about, their eyesight, and that we have three photoreceptors, which sees the primary colors, red, green, and blue. And then those can be combined to give us basically our palette of colors. Most birds and chickadees, these little tiny birds, have four photoreceptors. So they have red, green, and blue, and ultraviolet. Like, wouldn't you want a little of that? A little ultraviolet. So they can see things that have or are reflecting ultraviolet light that we can't see. And also they have something in their eyes that gives them an incredible fineness of detail. So when we just look at a branch, they see a branch with all of these little nooks and crannies, and they can see right into it and see a little insect. that's sitting there hiding. So I was thinking of that in terms of just aliveness and how different beings see things differently. Is it the same world? Is it a different world? One of the things that he was also talking about was how the eyes on birds can move independently, and they correspond to the opposite sides of the brain, and that allows them to do all kinds of miraculous things. And one of those things, they believe, is that birds can sleep while they're flying. And the way they do that is they keep one eye open and the other eye is closed. So I guess one half of their brain is sleeping. And I was thinking, I bet there's some Zen students that would like to be able to do that. Not while flying, but while doing something else. You know, when we talk about bypassing or just, you know, kind of following our patterns, our habits, in a way we could look at that as, you know, doing that because we think we know that that somehow corresponds to things well enough and it's going to get us what we want. And we, whatever we're encountering that we'd rather not encounter, we don't fully understand yet. And in that, we don't understand how it can be useful to us, right? We just experience it as obstructive or painful. We don't recognize yet how that is actually can be and needs to be useful. And it needs to be useful because here it is. Because it's arising, it is demanding to be used well. And so then we have to learn how do we use this well towards our own liberation? How can this serve us to actually strengthen our faith, our confidence, our spiritual powers? Living beings are all Buddha nature. Why then does it still have this skin bag? So, nirvana is to realize the unconditioned, that which is not born, doesn't die. The body clearly is born and dies. It's material. It comes together, it comes apart. Having realized Buddha nature, why then are we still carrying around this compounded form that suffers? Right? That gets old, it gets sick, it has aches and pains, it gets, you know, it's subject to all the things of life, like old age and death, thirst and hunger. So why, having Buddha nature, is the dog still in this body? And Xiaozhou says, it knows and deliberately transgresses. It knows and it dares to do so. In Zen, sometimes teachers speak of the family shame or the family crime, the family transgression, that to even speak of enlightenment, in a sense, is a transgression, brings something forth that can now be set against something else, like delusion. To speak of the self now establishes something that stands opposite other. But to understand, this is just a way of speaking, that there's no wrong here. It has to be spoken of. It has to be spoken of so we can study, so we can see into. A student once asked Master Xiaozhou, have any sages ever fallen into hell? Have any enlightened beings ever gone to hell? And Xiaozhou said, they're the first ones to go. And the student says, but they're enlightened teachers. Why would they fall into hell? And Xiaozhou said, well, if I didn't fall into hell, how could I help you? And of course, falling into hell seems like a decidedly bad thing. And Buddhism has a lot of hells you don't want to go to. It's quite creative in all of its many different hell realms, which are hellish, each in their own way. And we might think that this means the student is in hell, and so the teacher has to go be in hell with them. But now you've just got two people in hell. That's not helpful. And at the same time, Zhao Zhou cannot help the student from any place else. Zhao Zhou has fallen into hell without taking a step, without leaving heaven, without changing his place, without doing a thing. And so, of course, that begs the question, well, what is hell? What is falling into hell? If we say that it's all one, that everything's equal, there's no right and wrong, the world is breaking under the weight of all that is wrong, of all of our transgressions. In the question, in the koan of Baizhang and the fox, the old master said, was asked, does the lame being fall into causation? And he said, no. And he was made to live 500 lives as a fox, which is also considered not to be a good thing. And in the poem, Woman refers to this as the old man's 500 happy, blessed lives as a fox. And what they're describing is the essence of the Bodhisattva path, to deliberately, to know and deliberately transgress, to know and dare to be so. Joyful effort doesn't always mean happiness. If we think of happiness as a state of happiness, it comes and goes. It's delightful, it's wonderful, and it passes. Joyful effort, joy, is something more that is not so dependent upon conditions. Not so dependent upon conditions, depending on how dependent we are still on conditions. This joy, I think, is having deep faith in the path, in ourselves, in people, in the Dharma, in impermanence, and in a sense, in suffering, in delusion, which we can have faith in delusion when we understand it. Faith in it doesn't mean we want more of it, but it means we understand it. And so we can, in a sense, trust it to be delusion. It's like trusting our president, given all that we saw before the election. In a sense, should we be surprised at anything that we have experienced since? It was all there. It was all on display. What to me has been the most distressing is that, and he was elected. Knowing and daring to go there? I don't know that that's daring, actually. Another time, Zhao Zhou said, Buddha is affliction. Affliction is Buddha. And the student said, I don't understand. Whose house is afflicted by Buddha? Zhao Zhou said, everyone's afflicted by Buddha. The student said, how can affliction be avoided? Zhao Zhou said, why avoid it? How would you avoid it? Where would you go to avoid it? What is this that you're avoiding? Avoiding it, more affliction. Not avoiding it, perhaps the affliction no longer exists. And so the Bodhisattva enters into hell and affliction for a very particular purpose, to serve. And along the path, as we are being Bodhisattva babies at different states of our development, we enter into affliction and hell realms to develop ourselves. And sometimes we do that willingly and knowingly, and sometimes it just arrives on our doorstep. Vimalakirti is held up as sort of the example, one of the examples of this Bodhisattva. It says in the Vimalakirti Sutra that he seemed to eat and drink, yet always took nourishment from the taste of meditation. He appeared at the fields of sports and in casinos, but his aim was always to develop and mature those people who were attached to games and gambling. He visited the fashionable heterodox teachers, that is, teachers who were considered to be teaching Dharma that's not true. So he would visit them, speak with them, yet always kept unswerving loyalty to the Buddha. In order to be in harmony with people, he would associate with elders, with those of middle age and with the young, and would always speak in harmony and authentically about the Dharma to everyone, no matter what stage of life or condition they were in. He engaged in all sorts of businesses, but was not interested in profit or possessions. In order to train living beings, he would appear at crossroads and street corners, and to protect them, he participated in government. To develop children, he went and stayed in schools. To demonstrate the evils of desire, he would enter brothels. To establish drunkards in correct mindfulness, he would go to cabarets. Basically, he would go to all the places that a religious person isn't supposed to be. He would go into all of those dusts of the world places. Into those Buddha fields to develop living beings. Zhaozhou says, "Of course I fall into hell." Chasing the air, pursuing fragrance, cloud and water travelers. Unsui is the Japanese word for monk, monastic, cloud and water. Chasing the air, pursuing fragrance, cloud and water travelers. In noisy confusion, they make excuses and explanations. That's what he's pointing to in the pointer. Immeasurably great people are turned around in the stream of words. How can we break free? Zhaozhou, Hongzhi says, makes an even presentation and throws the shop wide open. He shows one side, he shows another side. Don't blame him for not being careful in the beginning. Pointing out the flaw, he takes away the jewel. The king of Qin didn't know Lian Zhangru. And this is the story of a king who sent an emissary with a jewel to make a deal with another ruler. And when the emissary got there, he gave the jewel and then realized they were planning something deceitful. They weren't going to follow through on the deal. And so he said, "Let me take a minute look at that jewel. I think there's a scratch." And so he took the jewel and he put it on his head and pushed it into the pillar. And he said, "You're deceiving me." He said, "Unless you make this right, I'm going to crush this jewel. How could you do this? How could you be so dishonorable?" And so they made it right. Pointing out the flaw, he takes away the jewel. The king, who was deceitful, didn't know Lian Zhangru. He didn't know the skill, the integrity, the honorable nature of this emissary. Hongzhi said, "Just resting is like the great ocean accepting hundreds of streams, all absorbed into one flavor. Those hundreds of streams are every sensation, every perception, everything we experience, all being absorbed into one flavor. Freely going ahead is like the great surging tides riding on the wind, all coming onto the shore together." So there's absorbing all of these streams into one flavor, turning the light around, and then there's freely going ahead like the great surging tides. And then he says, "How could they not reach into the genuine source?" Going this way, how could we not reach into the genuine source? How could we not realize the great function that appears before us? What he's really saying is, you will, in this way, reach into the genuine source. You will realize the great function. Turning in, examining, going to the source, realizing, and then moving out. He says, a student of the way follows movement and responds to changes in total harmony. Moreover, haven't you yourself established the mind that thinks up all illusory conditions? This insight must be perfectly incorporated. We follow movements, respond to changes in total harmony. So that's our aspiration, to harmonize. As Trungpa Rinpoche said, we should make a commitment to seeing the chaos in the world, to not add more. Seeing the confusion, to not bring more confusion. Seeing the greed and the anger, to not contribute, add to that. And in the same time that we're not adding that, we're bringing something else. Going ahead like the great surging tide. Just resting. Because it is so very close, it's hard to see. Because it is so very close, it's hard to see. I read a story about someone who studied birds and was observing this nest where there were a pair of nesting birds with chicks, and only one of them was in the nest. And at a certain point, it stood up suddenly and started making its greeting call to its mate. And so the scientist was looking and looking everywhere because there was no one in sight, no mate in sight. And so I thought, what is it calling to? And he kept waiting minute after minute after minute. It kept calling. He thought, what is it calling to? And then finally he looked out over the ocean and he saw this tiny, 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 tiny little black speck that he couldn't even tell if it was something. And then it was coming closer and closer, and he realized the mate. That the one in the nest was able to see beyond. Because that's its nature. And we have the nature to see beyond. One thing, all things move among them and intermingle without distinguishing, without dividing. When we live in this realization, anxiety about non-perfection falls away. And to live in this faith is the path to non-duality, because non-duality is one with the trusting mind. That in our faith, in our trust, in our patience, in all of these virtuous qualities, these enlightened qualities that we're developing, we are sitting within the non-dual reality, non-dual mind, our non-dual nature. That is our undivided nature. That is our peaceful nature, our awakened nature. And so, session will soon end. But what does that actually mean? It means something. We will have time together, we'll have lunch together, we'll have breakfast, we will talk. And within that, there's a continuity. And that's a really good way of practicing session, is that you're aware of time, but you're not trapped in time. And so that we're able to practice all the way through. And when we practice that way, we begin living that way. So practice session the way we want to live our lives, right? Because we're living it now.
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page, or scroll down and click on Retreats.